Welcome to Belfast City Vineyard, where we are pursuing formation in the presence of Jesus, community gathered around him, and the impact he empowers us to bring in our families, city, and the world. The following message was given at one of our Sunday services. For more information, visit our website at belfastcityvineyard.com.
Well, good morning. My name is Gunther. I'm part of the church family here at the Vineyard, and it's a real pleasure to be able to share with you guys this morning. One of my vices, that's a great way to start a sermon. Don't worry, we'll just move on. One of my vices is reading. I have an obscene amount of books in my house, and I particularly enjoy reading biographies and autobiographies. I have this weird eclectic collection covering everything from actors and musicians to historical figures, politicians, comedians, sports people. I find other people's stories really, really fascinating. And so this morning we're going to be taking a look at a biography, at a life story of a biblical character, Caleb. Now, to be entirely honest, we're not going to look at his entire life. So I don't suppose you could really call it a biography in the absolute truest sense, but we are going to be looking at two events that very much are the two moments in his life, if you like, that have really come to define him, that we remember him for, that we know him by, and they actually span between them almost 50 years, and they sort of bookend this sort of storyline or plotline in his life. So I think in a sense you could say it is his life story. And as we look at his story, we're not only going to hopefully have a good read, but also we're going to see something about courage, which is, of course, the theme, the topic that we've been pressing into over these last couple of months as a church. So let's dive right in. For this very first event, we're going to be taking a look at in Caleb's life. Would you turn with me, if you've got a Bible, to the book of Numbers? How often do you hear that? We don't even know where Numbers is. It's the fourth book of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and then Numbers. If you don't have a Bible with you, don't worry. The words will be on the screen here behind me. I'll throw them up in just a second. We're going to be taking a look at Numbers chapter 13, and just to kind of give you a little bit of background, here's what's happening so far in the book of Numbers. God's people have been rescued out of slavery in Egypt. Of course, it's a very famous event. You can read all about it in Exodus. And so they've come up out of slavery in Egypt with Moses. And now in the book of Numbers, in the first of nine chapters of Numbers, effectively what we see is them just kind of catching their breath and taking a little bit of time to get organized, to kind of prepare for the rest of the journey to the promised land. And if you've ever tried to even just take your family on holiday with, you know, just a handful of you, you can imagine 12 whole tribes and trying to get them all organized. It took a few months. And then we see in Numbers chapter 10 that they're ready to go, so they do. They set out, and after a few initial bumps and bruises and minor arguments, which kind of sounds like par for the course for a road trip, they eventually find themselves on the edge of the promised land, which is where we now find them here in chapter 13. So let's go ahead and read, then, shall we, what happens next. The Lord said to Moses, who of course is the leader of the people, he said, "Send some men to explore the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the Israelites. From each ancestral tribe," so each of the 12 tribes of Israel, "send one of its leaders." So they're going to do a bit of a reconnaissance trip. They've arrived, but they're just going to send some guys over to check the land out first. And they do what God says to Moses, what he instructs them to do, which is they choose 12 guys, one from each tribe. Our guy, Caleb, is the representative for Judah. I'm not going to read the entire list because you'd think a list of 12 names wouldn't be that long, but I don't know. They managed to do it because you've got not only the guy's name, which I'm happy not to pronounce in each instance, and who their father was, and you know where they're from and all that kind of stuff. So if you really, really want to see it, trust me, it's there in Numbers 13, verses 3 through 16. So you can keep reading that now while I press on to the rest. So they get all the guys together, and here's what Moses then says to them once we skip past the list of names in verse 17, once they've got them all assembled. When Moses sent them to explore Canaan, he said, "Go up through the Negev," so he's giving them directions, and onto the hill country. See what the land is like and whether the people who live there are strong or weak, few or many. So obviously, these are some pretty important factors. If you're going to go and live somewhere, you want to kind of know, well, who else lives there already and what's the land like? Is it good? And he says, what kind of land do they live in? Is it good or bad? What kind of towns do they live in? Are they unwalled or fortified? How is the soil? Is it fertile or poor? Are there trees in it or not? And then you can almost sense slight pause before Moses finally says, oh, and do bring back some fruit, because it was the season for the first ripe grapes. And you know, he's probably got a very good reason, which is he wants them to bring back a very tangible symbol, evidence of how fruitful the land is to show the people, so that makes complete sense. I think, though, that's probably a secondary level here. This is just in my mind, probably, which is after several months of being in the desert, he's just dying for some fresh fruit. So I think Moses has got two levels going on there. So they set out, and here's what we see happens next. Oh, wait, there's the, yeah. So they went up and they explored the land from the desert of Zin as far as Rehob, which is a town, towards Lebo Hamath, which is a valley. They went up through the Negev, which is a wilderness area that Moses just mentioned, and they came to Hebron, which is another town, where Ahiman, Sheshai, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak, lived. Hebron had been built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. And this is just, you know, when you're reading biographies and autobiographies, sometimes you just get these really fun facts. Here's a fun fact for you. At least I think it's a fun fact. So Hebron has been compared to Zoan in Egypt. And Zoan is the first ancient capital of Egypt, which later was named by the Greeks, Tanis. And if you know your Indiana Jones, what was buried in Tanis? The Ark of the Covenant. Sometimes it's just the little things that tickle you. So when they reached, our house is terrible. It's movie quotes. If you don't watch movies, you will probably never have an intelligent conversation with us. When they reached the valley of Eshcol, which is wine country, they cut off a branch bearing a single cluster of grapes. So just like Moses asked, two of them carried it on a pole between them, along with some pomegranates and figs. And to this day, the grapes from that region are absolutely huge. A cluster of them would weigh something like 5 kilograms, which is kind of impressive, but at the same time, it seems a little bit over the top to carry it on a pole between two guys, along with his other fruit. But of course, what they're trying to do is they're trying to keep the fruit safe on their journey, but they're mindful when they come back, they do want to make a big impression, don't they? They do want to kind of have this dramatic re-entrance with the fruit from the promised land. So we see then that the place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster of grapes that the Israelites cut off there. At the end of the 40 days, they returned from exploring the land. So I think you could say overall, it's been a good trip. You know, they've probably had some nice man-bonding time along the way. Men make fire, men talk around fire, that kind of thing. Moses, they've got his grapes. They've sold some pretty impressive things. And so they go back and they give their report to Moses. They came back to Moses and Aaron, who is, of course, Moses' brother and also his sort of right-hand man, and the whole Israelite community at Kadesh in the desert of Paran, which is where they've been waiting for them. So clearly there's great excitement because a lot of people have gathered to hear what the promised land is like, and you can just kind of sense the excitement. You know, just please, please tell the good news. You know, this is going to be really awkward if we've left Egypt and it's not good news. And so they're waiting. And they're not disappointed, because here's what they say. When they reported to them and to the whole assembly and showed them the fruit of the land, so, you know, the grapes and the figs and everything else, they gave Moses this account. We went into the land to which you sent us, and it does. It flows with milk and honey, which is something God promises Moses back in Exodus 3 at the burning bush when he calls Moses and he tells him, you're going to lead the people out of Egypt. That's something he said. Here's the fruit. So everybody's excited, understandably. You know, this is it. This is going to happen. You know, we could do this tomorrow. Heck, we could do this today. Grab your stuff. Let's go. But, and that's just not the word you ever want to hear after the good news. But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there, and Anak is a sort of legendary figure, part of a tribe of large warriors. So they obviously saw some impressive people, and they figure, well, that's who they must be descended from. And the Amalekites live in the Negev. And the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites, they live in the hill country. And the Canaanites live near the sea and along the Jordan. So, you know, there's people everywhere, this land that we're supposed to go and take possession of. There's people there already, and they're big. And you can just kind of sense the air getting sucked out of the place. You know, they were so excited for a few seconds, and now fallen flat. What are we going to do? We can't go back to Egypt. They're not going to be particularly happy to see us. Can't stay here. It's a desert. We'd die. We can't go there. You know, we're going to be beat up by giants. What are we going to do? And you can just kind of imagine murmurs spreading, you know, and this is quite a few people, several thousand, so it's quite a loud murmur. But just then, Caleb silenced the people before Moses, and he said, well, we should go up, and we should take possession of the land. We can certainly do it. Okay, people are thinking, maybe there's another angle to this. Let's cheer Moses out. Maybe it's not so bad after all. And, you know, the mood begins to shift again. But the men who had gone up with him are having none of it. And they said, we can't attack these people. They are stronger than we are. And they're so convinced that we see here that they spread amongst the Israelites a bad report about the land that they had explored. They said, the land we explored devours those living in it, which is kind of an unusual turn of phrase, but effectively what they're saying is the place is so bad, it's so brutal, the climate, the land, it's so bad that it kind of eats you alive. We saw people dying everywhere, which is kind of amusing because just a few minutes ago they said it's flowing with milk and honey and they brought back these huge grapes and things. But they go on, and all the people that we saw there, so now not just some of the people, okay, all of the people, they're of a great size. We saw the Nephilim there. The descendants of Anak came from the Nephilim. So we saw not just biggish descendants of giants, we saw actual giants. In fact, they're all giants. And there we seemed like grasshoppers in their eyes. And we looked the same to them. What a strange turn of events. After what seemed like such a good trip, especially when you consider that Caleb and these guys saw exactly the same things, what could possibly explain such a difference in accounts, a difference in viewpoints? I think it comes down to the perspective with which they each went into the trip in the first place. You know, the other guys, they genuinely did hope for the best, that they would go there, they would see something good, that the land would be fine, there wouldn't be too many other people living there. If they were, they'd just be kind of maybe a shepherds and a goat, and they would move on. But they didn't really have anything more solid to hold on to, that sort of vague hope that everything will somehow be okay. And so when things didn't go well, when they saw fortified cities and they saw these large warriors, understandably, their courage crumbled and their hearts sank. Caleb, on the other hand, went in with a very different perspective. There was something that God had promised his people through Moses at the burning bush in Exodus 3, which we mentioned just a moment ago. And Caleb had taken that promise so to heart, he'd clung onto it so dearly, made it so much a part of his life that it had actually begun to shape his perspective. And the promise was this. God says to Moses in Exodus 3, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. And so I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. So all the people groups that the men reporting back to Moses, they've just mentioned when they've said, oh no, we can't possibly go there because all these people are already there. Moses already knew that they would see them because God had told him. And they knew too So did Caleb, because Moses had then told everybody else in Exodus chapter 4. This promise that God would rescue them out of Egypt and bring them into an abundant place, even though there would already be all these people there. But he will be with them. And so they all knew this promise God had made. The difference is, once they were out of Egypt, so the first part of the promise had been fulfilled, Caleb still held on to and remembered the rest of the promise, but the other guys didn't. While the others just kind of went about their business, you know, it's so great to be out of Egypt, let's just get on with things, Caleb continued to take it to heart, to ruminate on and to mull over this promise that God had made, that there was still more to come, more than just rescue from Egypt. As incredible as that has been, that there was also this land of great abundance waiting for them. And yes, there would be people there, but God would be with them. He would bring them there safely, and they had nothing to fear. And that it's that promise, all of that promise that he held on to and that shaped his whole outlook. And I genuinely think that was the main difference that day. One perspective was based on a genuine but vague hope that somehow everything would be okay. And when it wasn't, their hearts sank and their courage failed. But Caleb's perspective was based on the promises of God, on his truth, on his words to them. And so when difficulty came, his courage actually rose. It soared. I think it's worth adding that it really did take courage for Caleb to say what he did, not only in terms of being willing to go back and, you know, take on these big walled cities and these large warriors, but also in terms of his own people and knowing that he was very much going to be in the minority with his point of view. He's been on the road for 40 days with these guys. He knows what their take on it is. They've talked about it a lot. They probably try to convince him a lot to just be quiet when they get back. And he also knows his own people's track record. He's kind of seen it in the past. He probably has a strong suspicion when they get back and they hear everything from both points of view, they're not going to side with him. They're going to side with the other guys because their default position was always panic. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. We see in Numbers 14, we'll not read it right now, but they do. They panic. And in fact, there's sort of a mutiny against Moses and against Aaron, and they want to elect a different leader, and they want to go back to Egypt. And so Caleb and Joshua, who was the only other guy on this exploration party who saw things the same way as Caleb, they try to intervene, they try to kind of reason with the people, and the people threaten to stone them. So he did. It took real guts, real courage to speak up when everyone except just a small handful of people saw things the way he did. And that brings us to the second event in Caleb's life that we're going to take a look at today. And this is in the book of Joshua. So if you leave Numbers and you go past Deuteronomy, you get to Joshua, and we're going to be looking at chapter 14. And here's what's happened since we last saw Caleb and we last saw the people of God. Decades have now passed. The people didn't choose a different leader that day. They didn't go back to Egypt, but they didn't enter into the promised land either. They should have right away. That was always the plan. But instead, as a result of their rebellion and their hard-heartedness, they end up wandering in the wilderness for another 40 years. And by the time we get to the book of Joshua, only two of the original generation who came up out of Egypt are left, Caleb and Joshua. And apart from them, it's a whole new generation. Joshua is now the leader. He and Caleb are still good friends. And at the beginning of the book of Joshua, the people of God have now finally started entering into the promised land after all that time. And so here's what we read now in chapter 14, which is about 5 years into the settling in process. Now the people of Judah, so that's Caleb's tribe, they approached Joshua at Gilgal. And Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, so that's our Caleb, said to him, "You know what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, at Kadesh Barnea about you. And I mean, Kadesh Barnea, of course, that's the place we just were. It's been some time for them, but that's the place they set out from on the exploration party, and they came back and they reported. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to explore the land, and I brought him back a report according to my convictions. But my fellow Israelites who went up with me made the hearts of the people sink. I, however, followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly. So far we know all this, right? But what we don't know is what happened next, and this is what we see kind of happen next after that report back. On that day, Moses swore to me, "The land on which your feet have walked will be your inheritance and that of your children forever, because you have followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly." So on that day, when they got back, and sort of Caleb and Joshua over here with their point of view, and everybody else was over here, God actually made another promise. He first made the promise about the promised land in general to the whole nation, and now he made this promise specifically just to Caleb through Moses. And he says, the place you've just been today, it will be yours one day. This is going to be your little patch, your little corner of the promised land. Now then, just as the Lord promised, he has kept me alive for 45 years since the time he said this to Moses while Israel moved about in the wilderness. So 40 years in the wilderness, and then another 5 years starting to get everybody else settled. So here I am today, 85 years old. I'm still as strong today as the day Moses sent me out. I'm just as vigorous to go out to battle now as I was then. I love his feistiness. You know, he's 85. Now, give to me this hill country that the Lord promised me that day. You yourself heard then that the Anakites were there, so those giant warrior people, and their cities were large and fortified. But the Lord helping me, I will drive them out just as he said. So then Joshua blessed Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and he gave him Hebron, that great city, as his inheritance. So Hebron has belonged to Caleb, son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, ever since, because he followed the Lord, the God of Israel, wholeheartedly. Hebron used to be called Kiriath Arba after Arba, who was the greatest man among the Anakites. And then the land had rest for more. What strikes me about Caleb in this second incident or event in his life, apart from just the marvelous feistiness that he has as an octogenarian, is that he finally got what God had promised him 45 years on. 45 years. Can you imagine? All that time, despite being threatened with death by his own people, despite knowing the challenges that lay ahead when they finally did set out for Canaan one day and the opposition they would face there, despite knowing it would now take another 40 years before that even happened and that only he and Joshua, amongst everyone who came up out of Egypt, would even be there. Despite all that, and the many years of waiting, and then still also, you know, just dealing with facing all of life's other challenges and problems and births and deaths and his body aging, and I'm sure some days he must have felt his spirit aging as well. He didn't lose heart. He kept the promises that God had made him, first to Moses at the burning bush, and then secondly, just to him. He kept the promises that God had spoken to him alive. He treasured them. He kept anchoring every inch of trust that he had in them, mulling them over, ruminating on them, talking to God about them. And as he did that, those promises shaped him. If anything, he just got feistier as he went along until he ends up as this 85-year-old fireball, trusting that the day would come. Come what may, the day would come that the Lord had promised the people of God and had promised to him personally, to Caleb. And he would and they would inhabit this land of flowing milk and honey. And now here he is. I think it's really appropriate what the name Caleb means. It means all heart or wholehearted. And that's what he was. You know, rooted in God's promises, he was all heart. So, where does that leave us then? I think, you know, biographies are, they're fantastic, they're good reads, They're inspiring a lot of the time. The challenge, though, whether you're reading about Caleb or some other biblical hero, or in fact, I would argue just any biography, any life story, is that it would be very tempting to walk away and either think, that's great, but I could never be like that. Or to think, well, if I just try hard enough, I can be something like that. I can too. I too can be bold and courageous and strong if I just, I don't know, if I just muscle it up. But in the case of Scripture, for sure, and I would argue probably all biographies really, that's not really the takeaway that God has for us. That we would think the point is to just kind of copy that person. Just do it, you know, just be courageous. Be courageous like Caleb. It won't work. I'm sure we've all done that, right? We've been inspired by whatever, YouTube video, book, doesn't matter. Yay! 10 minutes later, it's gone. That's not the point. So, of course, that begs the question, well, what is the point? How does his courage apply to us? I would summarize what I think we can take away and apply to our lives from the life of Caleb like this. It's less of a to-do list, and it's more sort of a framework, perhaps, or maybe a principle. I would sum it up like this. Godly courage comes not from just trying to be courageous. Godly courage comes from trusting in God's promises, regardless of the circumstances. Because that is what we see in the life of Caleb, isn't it? His courage isn't something that he has just worked up himself, that he's just kind of set his mind to. I don't actually think he set out to be courageous as such. But what has he done? He's taken the promises of God to heart, and he's mulled them over, and he's kept looking at them, and he's engaged with God about them, so much so that they have shaped how he sees everything else, which has then resulted, as the need arises, in courage. He sees everything through the filter of God's promises. What are you and I being shaped by? What are we holding on to, musing on, mulling over, taking to heart? What's influencing our thoughts and our viewpoints? Is it the things that he says to us about us and about him, who we are to him and his plans for our lives? Or is it anything else? You know, what other people say and what our culture says, what the voices in our own heads say, what our own feelings say, as good as those are, they tend to fluctuate a lot. It makes a big difference who or what gets to speak loudest into our lives. Who or what gets the most airtime, gets the most prominence. There's this famous illustration, you've probably heard it before, it goes something like this. There was a young professor who held up a piece of paper to his class, and on it was just a single black dot right in the very, very middle. And he says to his class, well, what do you see? And without fail, they all said, well, obviously, it's a black dot. And that's how they describe this page in the context of this black dot in the center. And he said to him, well, that's interesting, because clearly you're not incorrect, but did you realize that black dot is only 1% of the page? The other 99% is entirely clear. But you've defined the entire page purely in the context of that black dot. And he says, isn't it funny how we do that? And obviously not just with pages, but in life. It's just so much easier to zoom in on the dark bits, even when they're in the minority, and to let those define and shape how we see everything else. Now, obviously, that's not a perfect illustration. For one thing, the dark bits in our lives are often substantially bigger than 1%. Okay, and I don't think it would be healthy to in any way minimize or trivialize that. But I think it makes a good point. What we most zoom in on, what we most focus on, what gets the loudest voice, what gets the most airtime in our thoughts, in our hearts, it will shape how we see everything else. And as children of a living God, we are just in such a ridiculously unique position to hear directly from the maker and master of the entire universe, the one who put every star, every planet in place, who knows everything, and yet passionately pursues and loves us personally, and is with us, and is for us. We get to hear from him what his thoughts are, what his words are to us, about us, and about our lives. And the challenge for us, of course, is will we let that? Will we let him and his words to us and his promises to us shape us and change our perspective and thereby be our source of courage? What has God spoken to you in your life already? I would encourage you to dust those off. If you've written them down somewhere, find where that is. Dust them off, maybe metaphorically, because if you're like me, it's all digital. And just spend some time mulling that over, ruminating on it, talking to God about it, turning it over, and allowing it to speak loudly into your life. And you know, if you've never written things down before, I would encourage you to go home today, because let's be honest, tomorrow somebody's going to ask you, what was that sermon about? Just say, I don't know, it was great, but I can't tell you. Go home today, or do it now, ignore me, it's great. Really, go home and write down what God has said to you in the past. Do it before lunch, because after lunch, the coma sets in. If you have forgotten, that's fine. Ask God to remind you, or just ask him to tell you something new. He is extraordinarily generous. He will happily do that. You may be sitting here thinking, well, that's great, but honestly, I can't think of a time God has ever said anything to me directly, you know, personally. In a few minutes when we finish, I'm going to invite God to do that. I also want to really encourage you, though, don't forget, the greatest source of God's truth and promises we already have is Scripture. So here's just two promises to get us started. I just want to kind of read these for you and, in a sense, read this over you. Jeremiah 29, verse 11, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you, not to harm you, plans to give you a hope and a future." Romans 8, 38 to 39, "For I am convinced neither death nor life, nor angels, nor demons, neither the present, nor the future, nor any powers, neither height, nor depth, nor anything else in all of creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord." I know those apply to all of humanity ever, but they apply to you. They apply to me. Those are God's words. Those are his promises to us in terms of how he sees us, what he has for us in our lives, in the present, and in the future. And there's many more, of course. Just, I did this yesterday. It's great. Just Google God's promises. You and I are sought out. We are chosen. We are passionately loved sons and daughters of the living God. He is with us. He is for us. He cleanses our past. He inhabits our present. He plans a prosperous future for us. And as we take his promises and his words to heart, as we just keep remembering them, just remembering them, making a point every day, at some point, to remember them, to look at them, to read them, to mull them over, to talk to him about them, to engage with him about them. It's then that our courage soars. Not because we were, you know, working on being courageous. And I suspect we'll probably be very pleasantly surprised too. We'll go, ooh, where did that courage come from? It's not because we're trying to be courageous. We're just clinging to God's word, and we're just engaging with him about it. And you know, we may not have giants and fortified cities to contend with, or people who want to stone us, not literally anyway, but we do have big challenges in our lives, don't we? And we face real challenges also to be courageous at work, at school, at home. Lots of places where it would be just so much easier to be quiet, to not stand out. How will we possibly muster enough courage to do that? Well, we can't, of course. But we can hold on to, we can zoom into, we can draw deep to heart and mull over and talk to God about what He has said to us, His promises, and let Him shape our perspective and birth courage. Godly courage comes not from trying hard to be courageous. It comes from trusting in God's promises, regardless of the circumstances. I would also add, regardless how long it takes. I think there's a really special encouragement in the story of Caleb. If you've ever heard from God before, if He has promised something to you in the past, but you're still waiting for that promise to come to fulfillment, you know, maybe He's spoken to you about an aspect of calling in your life, or breakthrough in something, or perhaps even for someone who is dear to you. And you have, you know, you've taken those words to heart, and you have mulled them over, and you've talked to Him about it, and you've simultaneously tried to hold them lightly while also trusting in Him for their fulfillment. And the truth is, you're still waiting. I find it so helpful when I think of my own waiting to see Caleb wait for not 1 year, which I consider a very long time, but 10 years. No, not 10 years, 20, no, 45 years. I find that so encouraging because it tells me I am not on a fool's errand. I am not persistently, actively waiting for nothing. I really don't understand why some things have to take as long as they do. And let's be honest, it's not always easy to wait. But there's something I know about Caleb's feistiness that I love and I want. The way how, over time, when all logic decrees that he should have just lost heart and just become a shadow of his former exuberant youth self, the opposite happened. He kept holding on to those promises. He kept zooming in on them, and he held fastly to them, and they just kept shaping him to the point that he became this, you know, this fireball. I certainly would be very happy for that in my life. So that's what I want to encourage you this morning. If you find yourself waiting, don't lose heart. Don't think it's because you misheard God or because He lied to you or you've lost favor or He's given up on you. Keep trusting. Just keep on treasuring the things that God has spoken to you. Keep holding them dear. Mulling them over. Talking to Him about it. He will be true to His word. And He will transform you, and He will transform me in the process as we do that. And we will see courage rise when we least expected it. And we do live in a world that needs courage, don't we? I need it. I'm guessing you need it. I'm pretty sure the people around us need it. At work, at home, many places. But we can't possibly take upon ourselves the weight of somehow being courageous for everybody. It would just crush us. But what if courage doesn't come from being courageous? What if courage comes from God? And our part is just to trust Him and to just hold dear the promises, the truth, the things He has said to us about Him, about us, about His plans for us, regardless what the circumstances, regardless how long it takes. And as we focus more and more on the rest of the page and less on the black spot, He is good. He shapes us. He changes our perspective. And courage is born.
Thanks for listening to this message. For all the latest information about what's happening in the life of our church, or if you have any questions or comments, head over to belfastcityvineyard.com.